So please, be concerned about your neighbor, especially the neighbor who might have existing medical issues, or they're elderly, or just a person with heart and lung issues. They may be more likely to experience negative or possibly permanent symptoms from this virus. We now have 94 confirmed cases in Butte County, and that was actually a Friday, June 19th. And if we just wear our masks, even if they're a little bit uncomfortable during this heat wave, we can avoid another outbreak, which might close down the whole state again. And speaking of heat wave, it is hot this week. So remember to keep hydrated, stay out of the direct sun, wear your sunblock, be aware of your pets. And feel for those who don't have the luxury of an air-conditioned space as the temperatures reach well beyond 100 degrees. For KZFR and 90.1 FM, I'm Matt Fidler, reporting from Chico.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia, and we'll be talking about radical change.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? Yes, and how many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
This is KZFR 90.1 Chico, and you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Corona Conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets, with year-round markets on Wednesday mornings at the North Valley Plaza and on Saturday mornings at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico. The Chico Certified Farmers Markets, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. We want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. I'm Susan Chudy. Tonight we are previewing a new series on Ecotopia, Radical Change. In the past 2 years, Butte County has experienced a 1-2 punch that has knocked us back on our heels. Our people are still feeling the impact of the campfire, which has left many people food insecure and has exacerbated our efforts to find ways to house people. The COVID-19 virus has made that population even more vulnerable and created illness and confusion for many, many more of us. Our peaceful town has experienced little of the violence of many cities in the aftermath of the George Floyd murder, but Chico clearly still has open wounds from the police killing of Desmond Phillips, and many African Americans in our community suffer the subtle and not so subtle racism that permeates a community and a nation that has mindlessly ignored the experiences of people of color.
I'm Stephen Schutte. Our community reflects and demonstrates the deep problems that our country has allowed to fester without sufficient attention to the needs of millions of people who feel the impact of these problems. Healthcare, energy crises, water unpredictability, homelessness, hunger, prejudice, law and peace enforcement, children, drug addiction, mental health, and much, much more. As we develop this series, we would like to hear from you. Do you or someone you know have big ideas for big change? We're looking for people who are deeply involved in the issues and have ideas and plans for big changes, where to start to implement those ideas.
Now is the time for thinking about change in our attitudes, in our laws and policies, and in the application of the law. We need to scrutinize the unspoken attitudes and ethics that permeate ourselves and our institutions. Corporate greed and sexist and racist structures have dominated the last half century. We need, and more, we need radical change. Tonight we'll introduce a few of what we see as many needed changes, many that we're currently experiencing most excruciatingly. We'll take a short break and be back to talk about radical change. Here's Lift Every Voice and Sing. The lyrics are by a famous African-American poet, James Weldon Johnson. This is now often called the African-American National Anthem, but in the days when I first learned it, back in the 60s, it was still the Negro National Anthem.
To the heaven ring, ring.
Start our exploration of the issues that need radical change with law and peace enforcement and policing. In the aftermath, I'm sorry, I'm still recovering from that song. In the aftermath of George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis, the Los Angeles Times compiled a database of cases where people died at the hands of law enforcement in Los Angeles County. Since 2000, there have been nearly 900 killings by local police that were ruled a homicide by the county medical examiners. Almost all of the dead were men. Nearly 80% were black or Latino. More than 98% were shot to death. Criminal charges are rare. We're not in LA, and we don't experience this level of police brutality. Nonetheless, people in our county feel threat from the local police.
Natalie Hansen reported in the June 9 Enterprise Record. Requests for defunding the police department accompanied nearly a full week of protests of police brutality against the black community in Chico. City Manager Mark Orme said in 1 week the city has received hundreds of emails about the Chico Police Department and interest in whether the department should be more supported or defunded ahead of the council meeting tonight, which was postponed from last week. Over 200 emails provided to the ER by Deputy City Clerk Danny Rogers demonstrate concern from residents about Chico's compliance with proposed state laws about the use of force by police. All emails Rogers provided called for the change to the police department, and over half requested the city to become compliant with a new pending state law, Assembly Bill 392, requiring police officers to use other resources and techniques rather than resorting to excessive use of force.
There's been a great deal of talk about what defunding the police really means, reducing their budgets and giving money to other social services, or should police departments be dismantled and recreated anew? What are the alternatives to the structure and functioning of law enforcement as it is now constituted? How can funding be redistributed to bring in new training, other sorts of experts in conflict resolution, community collaboration to reduce tensions? We want to hear ideas for radical change.
Race is a difficult subject to talk about, but it's an issue that's long overdue in confronting. Many people are reluctant to admit the existence of racism. Those with white privilege are often unable to see their own whiteness and the advantage it enables. There are many, many books and articles that seek to uncover the depth and breadth of systemic racism in the U.S. So it's shocking that people still deny the existence of racism or see it as trivial or as playing the race card. A comment that dismisses the lived experience of people. In fact, a recent letter to the editor in the Enterprise Record does just that. The writer trivializes people's efforts to call out racism as efforts to, quote, instill guilt in even the most innocent, close quote. And when business and civic leaders, quote, apologize for fabricated sins, close quote. The writer accuses people of falling meekly into line, quote, once they've been called down for expressing an opinion outside the approved agenda. For this writer, racism is just a political game. Black Lives Matter is just a guilt trip. Martin Luther King talked about the need to change hearts and minds. What sort of radical change do we need to change hearts and minds?
An issue we've addressed again and again on this program is climate change. A few weeks ago, we interviewed Harriet Sugarman, who wrote a book about how to talk to your children about climate change. She wished that climate change could grab people's attention the way COVID-19 did, causing a whole country, a whole world, to stop in its tracks. As the pandemic has continued, however, people have wearied of the threats of danger and of staying home, and maybe that's the case with the impending disaster of climate change. This is just the way it is, so why should we change anything? The pictures of the climate disaster painted by environmentalists are grim, very grim, but they're not present, not right in front of our faces. What sort of radical change is needed to get people to act, to do what's necessary to mitigate the worst impacts of climate change? And the issue of climate change is huge, with many pieces that need acting on to stave off disaster. What radical change do we need in our energy policies? What radical change do we need in our economy, in consumerism? What radical change do we need in our use of water and our water policies? How can we make radical change to limit CO2 emissions?
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're talking about problems that require radical change, and we plan to address these in future programs. If you have ideas on any of these issues, let us know at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. One of those intractable problems that we face both locally and nationally is health care. Even before the COVID crisis, people were struggling with health care costs. A December 2019 poll conducted by Gallup found 25% of Americans say they or a family member have delayed medical treatment for a serious illness due to the costs of care. And an additional 8% report delaying medical treatment for less serious illnesses. A study conducted by the American Cancer Society in May 2019 found 56% of adults in America report having at least one medical financial hardship, and researchers warn the problem is likely to worsen unless action is taken. Despite millions of Americans delaying medical treatment due to the costs, the U.S. still spends the most on health care of any developed nation in the world, while covering fewer people and achieving worse overall health outcomes. A 2017 analysis found the United States ranks 24th globally in achieving health goals set by the United Nations. In 2018, $3.65 trillion was spent on health care in the U.S., and these costs are projected to grow at an annual rate of 5.5% over the next decade. High health care costs are causing Americans to get sicker from delaying, avoiding, or stopping medical treatment.
A 2009 study conducted by researchers at Harvard Medical School found 45,000 Americans die every year as a direct result of not having any health care coverage. In 2018, 27.8 million Americans went without any health insurance for the entire year. These statistics are not from obscure sources that we can't uncover. Gallup poll, United Nations, Harvard Medical School. This is widely available information, and yet we see healthcare used as a political football with little attention to facts and statistics and the most effort spent on fighting one's political opponents. People's lives are at stake. We need radical change in our healthcare system. Is there a way to defeat the political gamesmanship to really get radical change we need in healthcare?
And we need radical change with the military budget. While the budget might seem a little remote from our everyday experience, in fact, many of our social problems could be solved without a mammoth, overblown military budget. The United States spends more on its military budget than 144 countries combined, including the military budgets of Germany, the United Kingdom, Russia, France, Saudi Arabia, India, and China. According to Robert Artiga Valencia, it's $121 billion. That figure, by the way, of $121 goes beyond what the Pentagon offers as its budget of $705 billion. It's frequently cited by the Defense Department, but many military costs are masked under budgets, thus leading to this preposterous figure of $121.1 billion. That's how much more money the United States spends on its military than 144 other countries combined, at least according to the latest update to available data on military expenditures compiled by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. That's not to mention the number by which the United States also outspends the next seven largest military budgets combined, $40.1 billion. Both of these numbers are stark increases from last year's differences. Yet there appears to be no clear threat to the U.S. that would warrant such a dramatic increase in spending. So let's think about how this $121.1 billion, which could have instead provided 11 million veterans with decent health care, according to our budget trade-offs. Let's think about how it's being spent. We're running 800 military bases in 80 different countries, most of which are generally unsupervised in their carbon emissions. So not only are we making the world less safe with our enormous military presence, but we are literally in the process of making our world uninhabitable. As a result of our military actions overseas, at least 244,000 Afghan, Iraqi, and Pakistani civilians have been killed in horrific ways, including tens of thousands of children. These are at least 244,000 more reasons to have a conversation about what exactly we celebrate every year on Memorial Day. Lastly, one would not assume all of this military action would at least be in the interests of the American people. Not so. In fact, our reliance on military spending has damaged many sectors of the economy, prevented us from funding government functions that actually help people. This is both a short-term consequence in that the opportunity to invest in other industries is lost and hundreds and thousands of potential jobs squandered, and also long-term as every dollar invested into the military instead of, say, education or clean energy programs is a dollar invested into the destruction of our planet and the continued drone bombing of weddings.
So who's this all for? Well, half of the Pentagon's budget goes to the private military contractors that provide the goods and service that the Pentagon buys, and much of that money ends up in the pockets of corporate executives who run those companies, as opposed to the actual troops themselves, or veterans. That suggests that the elites running the Pentagon have other uses in mind for all that money, like supporting defense CEOs who fly around with not one, but two private jets. It's safe to say that most of that money does not support the troops or operations that benefit most people in the United States. Let's be honest about where our money is really going and start having conversations about how we could redirect that money toward projects that protect the planet and all of its inhabitants, not just a privileged few. Our take of Valencia's commentary can be found at the National Priorities Project website at nationalpriorities.org.
An analysis by Fred Kaplan in Slate.com on February 12, 2020 concludes, "The White House's own book-length summary of the overall budget reveal that the Trump administration is requesting $20 billion more for military programs than for all the other federal programs combined, and that this difference is projected to grow in the coming years. It also reveals that, whereas next year's military budget will increase by $5 billion, federal student loan programs will be cut by $6 billion. Medicaid and children's health programs will be cut by $8 billion, and cuts in welfare programs, which the White House labels reforms, will be cut by $20 billion. The military budget seems far away and unreachable to those of us who live in Butte County, but clearly the federal budget has a huge impact on us, all of us. Veterans, people who live at or below the poverty level, people who rely on a public safety net, and all of us who pay attention clearly see the need for radical change in military spending."
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, and we are identifying some of the issues we hope to address in our coming radical change programs. If you have strong opinions about what we should be doing to solve those problems, serious change, not just tinkering, we'd like to hear from you at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. We'll take a short break and be back to talk about poverty and homelessness and why we need radical change. We'll listen to... I forgot what we're going to listen to. Wait, Imagine, this song by John Lennon. Sure. I love the version by John Lennon, but I also love this version by Joan Baez. Right. And it speaks to the things we're speaking to. We need imagination for change.
imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
You are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, and we're talking about our new series on radical change. Another area in which we need radical change is in the way wealth is distributed in this country. Just a couple of statistics. 41.4% of all Americans are classified as low or low income families. The top 1% earns 40 times more than the bottom 90%.
An article by Greg Kaufman in USA Today is entitled Poverty in America, Pandemic and Police Killings Reveal Brutal Status Quo. We can fix this. Why don't we? Here's what Greg Kaufman has to say. I've covered poverty in America for more than 10 years, and for me there is a certain kind of madness that comes with the beat. It stems primarily from witnessing profound and unnecessary human suffering caused by bad policy choices, from food to health care to policing, and a rage toward policymakers who maintain a steady drumbeat of baseless claims such as, quote, we need more data to know what to do. Or worse, blame people for their poverty by portraying them as lazy, scheming, dependent, or anything else to suggest that the system is just fine, but these individuals are broken and unworthy of assistance. With the COVID-19 pandemic and the ceaseless killings of unarmed black people, that madness has revisited with a vengeance. Both diseases plainly reveal yet again the economic and racial inequities that plague us. We see who is essential and the abhorrent wages and benefits many receive for that essential work. Who has adequate health care and who doesn't have health care at all? Who can Zoom to work and who risks their lives so that others can quarantine? Who is most ravaged by the virus and who is most protected? Indeed, it is clear who is valued as fully human and whose lives aren't viewed as mattering much, if at all.
Greg Kaufman continues, a brutal, sometimes fatal status quo. The same racism and dehumanization that allows for the continued killing of black men, women, and children also creates and sustains a status quo of tens of millions of people living in poverty, including more than 30% of black children and 29% of American Indian, Alaska Native children. Additionally, 140 million people, more than 40% of the country, aren't officially poor, but can't afford basic necessities. And the median net worth of black households is $17,600 compared to $171,000 for white households. Privilege. If people on food stamps made Jared Kushner's paperwork mistakes, they might starve. It's no great mystery as to what we could do immediately and dramatically to reduce poverty. We need to insist that everyone have the same basic privileges that policymakers themselves enjoy. That starts with a living wage for workers so they can take care of themselves and their families. It means being able to take sick leave, paid sick leave, or family leave to look after oneself or a loved one. It involves having quality, affordable child care so parents are able to go to work without worrying about whether their kids are safe. It means everyone having access to comprehensive health care, and it means prioritizing and investing in black neighborhoods where disinvestment and intentionally created barriers to opportunity have been the norm. These are no-brainers. The low-hanging fruit legislative reforms that most in the nation agree are both vital and just. A bigger hurdle is ensuring that everyone has access to the basics that we all need to survive: food, housing, health care, continuing education, home income security, equal protection. Additionally, the government should provide a good job for anyone who wants to work when the private sector falls short. Reparations must be paid for the stripping of wealth from generations of black Americans through today. And the United States must make good on its treaties and obligations to American Indians and Alaska Natives.
Greg Kaufman continues, the challenge is history, not money. These strides forward aren't difficult because they are too expensive or because we don't know what to do. The challenge lies in overcoming a history of demonizing people who are poor or near poor, and political leaders who racialize poverty to diminish popular support for good policy. There is a through line of denigration and racism that runs from Ronald Reagan straight through to Donald Trump, who would nix health care coverage for the nation's most vulnerable people during a pandemic, no less. The double standard on Medicaid work requirements, who will judge the character judges? In order to move forward, we need to fight hard to remove the shame and stigma of poverty, in part by calling out those who do the shaming and stigmatizing. They are the ones worthy of our shame, the ones we should be embarrassed by, the ones who stand in the way of contributing to grow to a vibrant and inclusive democracy and economy. A last element of the madness that arises from poverty reporting is the number of times one quotes some smart policy person who says something along the lines of, "What's lacking isn't the resource, it's political will." A lack of political will to treat everyone as fully human has led to more than 114,000 dead due to COVID-19 and the never-ending killing of unarmed black people. Let this mark the last year we ever need to write about a lack of political will.
Greg Kaufman is calling for radical change in the way we treat and see people, in our failure to treat everyone as fully human. This radical change calls for a change in our policies and in our attitudes.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We're talking about the need for radical change. In Butte County, a need for radical change we are feeling acutely is homelessness. Throughout the country, this radical change is called for. Let us know your thoughts about this issue and others that you see as requiring radical, paradigm-shifting change. Send us an email, ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. In a Cal Matters, California Homeless Crisis and Possible Solutions Explained, dated January 8, 2020, Matt Levin and Jackie Bott set out the issues. California's most vexing issue is also its most shameful, the large and rising number of residents who lack a safe place to call home. In a state with vast amounts of wealth, more than 150,000 of its residents sleep in shelters, cars, or on the street. The United Nations compared the tent encampments of San Francisco to the slums of New Delhi and Mexico City. Nearly 5,000 people live in the half-square mile of Los Angeles's Skid Row. And while the problem is most acute in California's urban centers, homelessness is now a common fixture in many of the state's suburbs and rural towns. State and local officials have pledged billions in recent years to help, but voters remain frustrated by the lack of visible progress. President Donald Trump has wielded the state's homelessness woes as a political cudgel, excoriating Governor Gavin Newsom and the state's progressive policies for allowing the country's best highways, our best streets, our best entrances to buildings to be blockaded by people without homes. In a Christmas Day tweet, Trump repeated his threats of federal intervention if the state fails to fix the problem.
Here's what you need to know about California's homelessness crisis, including possible solutions. First of all, how many homeless are there? At the last official count, 151,278 individuals are homeless in California, according to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. That's the highest number since at least 2007 and represents a nearly 17% uptick since 2018. The number of unsheltered Californians living on the streets or in cars has surged the past year. Official homelessness statistics mostly come from one-night counts, a volunteer-led snapshot of the number of people experiencing homelessness one night in January. Experts say this method likely underestimates the unsheltered and doesn't capture the total number of people who fall into homelessness over the course of a year, which could be 2 to 3 times higher. It's not surprising that California, the largest state, has the biggest homeless population in the country. But while about 1 in 9 Americans lives in California, roughly 1 in 4 homeless Americans live here. New York and Hawaii have slightly higher per capita rates of homelessness, but California has the largest proportion of people living without shelter. That means the state's homeless population is far more visible than in other places and more vulnerable to the illness, violence, and death that accompany living on the street. And although states such as Texas and New York have seen a slight uptick in their homeless count since last year, California saw the largest proportional swell of any state besides New Mexico. The Trump administration is quick to point out that the country would have seen an overall decline in homelessness if California and Oregon were excluded from the count.
Who are they? Matt Levin and Jackie Bott continue. Governments and services providers tend to focus their efforts on the chronically homeless. An individual with a disability who has lived without consistent shelter for a year or has had multiple recent bouts of homelessness. About 26% of Californians experiencing homelessness fit that definition, or some 34,000 people. African Americans are disproportionately found on California's streets. Roughly 30% of the state's unhoused population is black, according to Housing and Urban Development. Several Bay Area regions, including San Francisco and Marin County, have some of the highest rates of black homelessness in the country. a legacy of racial discrimination in rental housing, higher rates of poverty among black families, and overrepresentation in the state's incarceration and child welfare systems all contribute to the high number of African Americans experiencing homelessness. A person experiencing homelessness is about twice as likely to be male than female and significantly more likely to be LGBTQ than in the population at large. A large proportion are seniors, with new research indicating nearly half of all seniors on the street fall into homelessness after age 50.
Are they local or are they coming from someplace else? One of the more enduring myths about California's homeless population is that the vast majority have traveled here from other states seeking generous government assistance and weather more hospitable to living outdoors. It's a baseless claim perpetuated by both sides of the aisle. Governor Newsom has made it repeatedly. While comprehensive statewide data is lacking, local surveys indicate that people living on the streets are typically from the surrounding neighborhood. Example, 70% of San Francisco's homeless people were housed somewhere in the city. When they lost housing, only 8% came from out of state. Three quarters of Los Angeles County's homeless population lived in the region before becoming homeless. There's little evidence to suggest undocumented immigrants constitute a large share of California's homeless population, but those that are unhoused are particularly difficult to help. Crucial safety net resources such as Social Security, Section 8 housing vouchers, and food stamps are unavailable to the undocumented, who often resist engagement with homeless service providers because of deportation fears. Language and culture barriers also complicate rehousing efforts.
A welcome decrease in veteran and family homelessness. Military veterans at a higher risk of mental illness and substance abuse issues make up a disproportionate share of the country's homeless population. Roughly 11,000 veterans experience homelessness in California on any given night, about 8% of the state's total homeless population. Most vets experiencing homelessness are over the age of 50 and often have significant disabilities and medical conditions that are exacerbated by precarious housing situations. Military members who experienced an episode of sexual trauma during their service are at especially high risk. The good news is that the number of vets living on the streets has declined significantly over the past decade, both nationally and in California. Experts credit initiatives from the Obama administration incentivizing a housing-first approach, where permanent housing is provided without preconditions for addiction or mental health treatment. This to help homeless vets. The city of Riverside succeeded in housing all 89 of its homeless veterans after adopting that approach. Homelessness among families is also down over the last decade. Still, about 8,000 families and 14,000 children were homeless in California last year, according to point-in-time estimates. Unlike households without children, those with at least one child are far more likely to utilize emergency shelter or transitional housing. One striking statistic: infancy is the age at which a person in the United States is most likely to be found in a homeless shelter. Several studies have found strong correlation between early childhood housing instability and behavioral and learning difficulties later in school.
High rents drive up homelessness. Mental health problems, addiction, childhood trauma, interaction with the criminal justice system, and poverty all play significant roles in whether someone becomes homeless. But the primary reason? They can no longer afford rent. About 1.3 million California renter households are considered extremely low income, making less than $25,000 a year, according to the California Housing Partnership, a nonprofit organization the state created to advise affordable housing builders. Predictably, these financially strapped households can barely afford the state's escalating rents and are most at risk of falling into homelessness. Fueled by decades of underproduction, California's stock of naturally occurring affordable housing is dwindling as shoddy older apartments that used to house lower-income families are increasingly taken over by higher-income tenants. Government-subsidized housing has not filled the gap. That's partly because doing so would be insanely expensive. The nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office estimates that building new housing for every low-income Californian who needs it would cost $15 to $30 billion annually. That's what the state currently spends on Medi-Cal, its massive program to provide health care to the poor, which covers a third of the state's residents.
And what about mental illness and addiction? Advocates for homeless people are leery of casting too much blame for the state's crisis on mental health and substance abuse issues. They argue that plenty of low-income residents in other states struggle with drug addiction and debilitating psychological conditions. They simply manage to remain off the streets because the rent is cheaper. But recent data suggests these issues are more prevalent among people experiencing homelessness than previously reported, especially for those living on the street. About half of the unsheltered nationally report that mental health and or substance abuse contributed to their loss of housing. An L.A. Times investigation found two-thirds of L.A. County's residents living on the streets suffer from a psychological or substance abuse disorder, far more than what's been reported in official statistics that exclude mental order disorders that aren't long-term. Methamphetamine use is up across the West Coast and is often to blame for some of the most visible episodes of homelessness seen on California streets. Unfortunately, physicians say meth addiction is confoundingly difficult to treat. While methadone is available to wean heroin addicts off of opioids, no such replacement medication exists for meth. Worse still, meth can exacerbate existing mental illnesses. Addiction and psychological conditions are often inextricably intertwined and present a complex case for outreach. They require outreach workers, or more often law enforcement, to confront. A disconcerting number of California board and care facilities, which have traditionally housed low-income patients with schizophrenia and other severe conditions, have shuttered in recent years. Many have also blamed California's conservatorship law for making it too difficult to compel treatment for people with mental illness or drug addiction living on the street. Civil libertarians and disability rights groups argue that conservatorship, when a court-appointed official manages another person's life, including medical decisions, should be used as sparingly as possible, as it risks violating civil liberties and is a hollow remedy given the severe shortage of actual treatment options. Under a 1967 state law known as the Lanterman-Petras Short Act, Californians can be held for treatment against their will only if they are deemed a danger to themselves or others, or are determined to be gravely disabled. Other states, such as New York, do not impose such strict requirements. California is experimenting with allowing three counties to take legal power over mentally ill people living on the street, but only in limited circumstances. Finally, there is the eternal question of cause and effect, the severe stresses people face when they lose shelter and are forced to live exposed on the streets can also wreak havoc on their mental health and lead to substance abuse.
Other factors that cause homelessness. Survivors of domestic violence are among those at high risk of homelessness. One California study found that women reporting an episode of domestic violence were four times more likely to suffer housing instability than other women. The formerly incarcerated, ineligible for many public housing programs, and frequently a target of discrimination in the rental housing market, often take refuge in emergency shelters or on the streets. While comprehensive California data is lacking, one study by a criminal justice reform advocacy group found that people who have been in jail or prison are 10 times more likely to experience homelessness than the general public. Youth aging out of the foster care system likely constitute a significant share of the more than 11,000 homeless young adults in California. One study found 30% of former foster care lacking family support networks and often victims of childhood traumas, about 25% of California's youth youth transitioning into adulthood live in precarious housing situations.
Emergency shelters and permanent supportive housing. California has a patchwork of government-provided housing for people experiencing homelessness. While the nomenclature varies from city to city, the two most prevalent and important categories of housing are emergency shelters and permanent supportive housing. Emergency shelters are any facilities that provide temporary shelter for people experiencing homelessness. At their most basic, they are barracks-like arrangements of cots, provide a bed and a meal. Typically, they are operated by publicly funded nonprofit and religious organizations. Many shelters bar residents from staying with partners or pets and are often viewed by homeless people as dangerous and dirty, even compared to sleeping on the streets. A KPCC investigation of Los Angeles area shelters last year found reports of rats, bedbugs, foul odors, and harassment rampant at several shelters. But while shelter beds frequently go unused in Los Angeles County, where transportation is also a complicated factor, overall the state has a major shortage. Federal funding has shifted away from emergency shelters over the last decade, causing the Bay Area, for example, to lose 1,700 shelter beds since 2011, according to the Bay Area Council Economic Institute. San Francisco and Los Angeles have tried to reinvent emergency shelters, equipping them with health and social services providers who can help guide residents to more stable housing outcomes. According to city officials, more than 50% of the short-term residents of San Francisco's navigation centers, which are tailored to the high-needs clients, are ultimately placed in housing. Emergency shelters are generally much cheaper to build than permanent supportive housing, but new projects often run into stringent community opposition.
Mm-hmm. How expensive is building new homeless housing? Permanent supportive housing. Homelessness experts agree that emergency shelters are mostly just a Band-Aid. Permanent supportive housing is the long-term solution. Usually targeted at the chronically homeless, this offers a highly subsidized apartment paired with support services, including psychological counseling, substance abuse rehab, and job training. Permanent supportive housing is the pillar of the Housing First model of ending homelessness. Individuals don't need to quit drugs or agree to participate in any program to get a permanent roof over their head. Studies show that once placed in permanent supportive housing, residents tend to stay off the streets and out of hospital and jail, saving taxpayers considerable expense. One problem? Permanent supportive housing is really expensive to build. In Los Angeles, a recent estimate from the city auditor put the median cost of building one unit at more than $530,000. A new project online in San Jose is estimated to pencil out at roughly $470,000 per unit. The outrageous price tags aren't just driven by land costs. A shortage of construction labor and prolonged city approval processes are also to blame. Cities, including Oakland, have recently begun buying and converting single-room occupancy hotels to sidestep prohibitively high new construction costs.
Preventing homelessness. California cities have made significant strides in moving people from streets and shelters into safe, stable housing. The L.A. Housing Services Authority, buoyed by fresh state and local funds approved by voters, estimated that it was able to place more than 20,000 people experiencing homelessness into housing last year. States and local governments across the country, including California, are devoting a rising share of homelessness resources to prevention strategies. This includes eviction counseling and defense, emergency rental assistance, diversion, and rapid rehousing.
We have a number of groups and individuals who have been working hard here in Chico and in Butte County on ways to house homeless people. There have been some remarkable successes. But sadly, NIMBYism and the dehumanization of people who are homeless and poor has blocked a number of practical and relatively fast ways to begin to get people into homes. We need radical change. We need to seize this moment to move forward. Ecotopia focuses on environmental, technological, and social systems. In the next several weeks, we'll be focusing on radical change in all of these areas.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. Contact us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. We would like to hear your ideas about what needs radical change and suggestions for interviewees that we can talk to about radical change. Again, our email is ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. We're also on the web at ecotopiakzfr.com. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. people free.